Hi, I'm Haley.
And I'm Bree.
And this is Calendar of Crime, where each week we examine a case from this week in history. Today's case comes from Cameron Park, California, when in May of 2002, a 45-year-old nurse was discovered missing after not attending her shift at work. Her friends and family knew she would never disappear on her own, so they report her missing and police quickly begin investigating the disappearance of Jan Scharf. At the time of her disappearance, Jan Scharf was described by her loved ones as having a wonderful life. She was very close with her daughter Amy and was actively working to plan her wedding, which was supposed to take place at the end of the year. At the same time, she was involved in the process of finalizing her own divorce with her estranged husband, Glenn, and had recently begun getting out there to meet new people. On Saturday, May 18th, she was scheduled to work at the UC Davis Medical Center, where she was an emergency room nurse. At that point, she had been working there for about 15 years. She had really good relationships with her coworkers and was close enough with some of them that she had even made plans with them for the summer. She had also just applied for a promotion that she had told her work friends that she was really excited about.
The fact that she applied for a promotion at work right before going missing is incredibly suspicious. People planning on running away wouldn't bother trying to get a promotion at work, so I would also be on the immediate defensive if I was in this situation.
Yes, definitely. Her coworkers reported that it was super unlike her to miss a shift, and they couldn't think of any reason why she wouldn't have come into work that day. After finding out that Jan didn't show up to work, her daughter Amy and her mother Janice called the sheriff's department to report her missing.
Investigators started quickly trying to piece together Jan's last steps. First, by figuring out who was the last person to see Jan. They quickly realized that it had actually been days since anyone had seen or spoken to Jan. Her daughter Amy reported last speaking to Jan on May 14th and described her as being in a good mood. Amy said she got no indication that anything was wrong. Jan's coworkers told police that she had worked a 12-hour shift at the hospital that same day, leaving around 7 p.m. While she was driving home, she talked on the phone to a guy she was dating, and their conversation ended sometime shortly before 8 p.m. Police questioned Jan's estranged husband, Glenn, and he reported that he last saw her on May 14th as well, at about 8 p.m. at their marital home.
A little backstory on the divorce that they were going through. Glenn and Jan had been married since 1988. Things had soured over time, and they had become legally separated in September of 2001, and Jan ultimately filed for divorce in December of 2001, citing irreconcilable differences. Around May 8th, 2002, Jan's divorce attorney had sent a letter to Glenn with a proposed marital settlement agreement that would finalize their divorce. They were still technically living together, but Glenn was spending most nights at his girlfriend's house and reported that he would stay at the home once a week to do laundry, get his mail, stuff like that. Glenn also worked in the medical field, and he worked as a paramedic for a private ambulance.
I imagine that was super uncomfortable. Like, you do hear about it happening. People live together even though they're in the process of a divorce. But I personally can't imagine doing that.
No, I would definitely be super uncomfortable in that situation. From what I understood from the source material, they were still in the process of selling the home at that time. And this was supposed to save them money until the house was sold and their divorce was completely finalized.
When police spoke with Glenn, he told them that he saw Jan after she got home from work on the 14th and they engaged in a short conversation. He stayed at the house that night in a different room and told police that at 6:40 the next morning when he got up for work, Jan's bedroom door was closed and her car was gone. He said he noticed that she had made coffee, so he cleaned the coffee pot and went to work. Usually Jan left for work at about 5:30 a.m., so this would have been plausible if Jan had had work that day. But May 15th was her day off, so something wasn't adding up. The day after Jan was reported missing, her 1996 Ford Explorer was found parked outside of a 24-hour fitness in the next town over. She did have a membership for this gym, but police followed up and found that Jan had not checked into the gym. Her car was searched, but no evidence was recovered.
Local media soon started reporting that in the month before her disappearance, Jan had made two calls to the El Dorado County Sheriff's Department. On April 24th, Jan called to report that a gun was missing from her home. She called again on May 4th and reported that she believed that she was being poisoned by someone drugging her coffee, coffee that she made at home.
Well, clearly there was already something going on before she went missing if these calls were weeks in advance of her disappearance. And those are really kind of crazy calls. A gun missing, her coffee being poisoned. I don't know how I feel about that.
Oh, definitely. Both of these reports, in my opinion, though, would point directly to someone who would have regular access to Jan's home. What I do find wild, though, is that police interviewed Glenn twice in the first few days after Jan disappeared, and they reported that they were not considering him a suspect. They claimed that they had no reports or evidence of domestic violence or threats against Jan.
That's pretty interesting. Just logically, if Jan was living with only her estranged husband, who else would have access to her personal belongings and her coffee pot? Or, I don't know, do you think that maybe they didn't believe the reports that she made?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense. Jan told investigators that she thought she may have been poisoned after feeling nauseous during a shift at work. She told her coworkers that she was afraid that digoxin had been slipped into her coffee, which is a medication that you can use to slow or control a heart rate. She had had her blood drawn to do a test, but police didn't have access to those records immediately. They did say that they plan to subpoena the results once they returned from testing.
Within a few days of her disappearance, investigators had come up with four theories. One, Jan disappeared as a result of a domestic dispute. Two, a stranger could have abducted her from the gym parking lot. Three, she left on her own. Or four, she disappeared with someone she met on the internet. Regardless, Detective Gregory Brown told the Sacramento Bee that the disappearance was still being treated as a missing persons case because, quote, we haven't established a crime. A local fund contributed $5,000 in reward money for information on Jan's whereabouts.
The requirements for establishing a crime in a missing persons case is never going to cease to amaze me.
Oh, absolutely. We go on and on about this in almost every episode that we do surrounding a missing person. And at this time in history, missing adults advocacy was significantly less common than agencies helping to find missing children. In 2001, almost 25% of all missing persons reports to the FBI were over the age of 18. So support was definitely needed, but there weren't a lot of agencies doing the work. Jan's friends and family had to become her advocates by holding news conferences, organizing fundraisers, creating a hotline, and hosting events like a candlelight vigil to get attention for Jan's case.
In the weeks after going missing, Jan's phone made no calls and her ATM card was left untouched. Authorities conducted over 40 interviews associated with her disappearance, including Glenn, Jan's friends and coworkers, people from the gym, and acquaintances from the online dating site that she was using. Officials also revealed that they searched Glenn's truck as part of the investigation, but they didn't find any evidence and he was still not being considered a suspect. Jan's friends and family continued to be vocal that Jan was completely reliable and wouldn't just run away.
I feel like the police really need to take it seriously when a victim's friends and family are stating what a victim's known behavior is. If they're saying this person would not run away, then the police should take that seriously and they should act on that information because the police don't know the person like their friends and family do.
I absolutely agree. What is the point in doing all of this investigative work if you're not going to actually follow up on the investigative information that you find from that work?
Yeah, exactly.
2 months after the disappearance, a mother and two children were walking along a bike trail in a nearby town when they found a body and reported it to the authorities. The body was badly decomposed and found on a slope near the Rainbow Bridge on the American River in Folsom, which is the same city where her gym and her car was located. Authorities immediately thought of Jan Scharf and told reporters that they planned to get dental records to try to ID the body. The body showed no signs of obvious trauma, and the autopsy was unable to conclusively state a cause of death. But the police soon confirmed that the body found on the slope was not Jan's, and they still had no further leads in the case.
Did they ever ID who that body was?
Yeah, they actually did. Although they didn't end up reporting who the victim was or what the cause of death was. It turned out that it was the body of a 54-year-old woman who lived in Sacramento and was a former resident of Folsom. So they were local to the area, but they didn't give any other information about what could have happened to her. They did say that they were withholding the name of the victim because they were still trying to contact family to inform them. But they never followed up, as far as I could see. I searched through a bunch of articles. What's really weird to me about this, though, is that they did report that the victim was found with a paper bag near her body, and inside that paper bag was an ID card that matched the body. I'm not trying to point fingers here, but isn't that like Occam's razor? I don't know why they would have reported that it might have been Jan, and I don't know why officials would have thought that it might have been Jan when clearly the most obvious answer was right in front of them. The identification that was found with the body belonged to the body. It just seems like a really strange route to take for me.
At this point, the case came to a halt until May of the following year. The wedding that Jan had been helping her daughter to plan had been canceled, and the reward for information had been increased to $15,000. Between the last time that anyone had spoken to Jan and the one-year anniversary of her disappearance, the Lacey Peterson case had attracted a huge amount of publicity. Most people know how big the Lacey Peterson case was in the media already, but these cases were only about an hour and a half to 2 hours away from each other, so they were fairly local by California standards. Jan's friends and family began to feel frustrated with the search efforts put up by the local authorities. Jan's case wasn't receiving nearly the same amount of publicity or coverage as the Lacey Peterson case, and when you're looking for a missing friend or family member, the amount of coverage you get can really affect the outcome of a case.
I'm sure it's super frustrating when you're trying to get recognition for your loved one and the authorities and the media just seem unfocused. I feel really strongly about victim advocacy and having their story told, but the media really ran away with the Peterson case at times, and in my opinion, it completely took away from the focus of the victims.
I know we just did a few episodes about the Chandra Levy case, which was also local, also the same time period, where the media also got really carried away. But back in 2003, while everything was happening, there were even articles about the real estate value of the Peterson home, as if that had any value in helping to find Lacey. Even now, you can still find articles about it, literally from May of 2022, because apparently that house just sold. It just doesn't sit right, and I'm sure that Jan's family was feeling incredibly overwhelmed with seeing media like that rather than feeling like Jan's story was being heard.
Definitely. The authorities said that they had conducted many searches for Jan, including some that they didn't disclose publicly. The neighborhood that Jan lived in was initially canvassed after her disappearance, and canine units searched a 2-mile radius around the home. Despite not publicly pointing to any new leads, the authorities did confirm in an interview with the Sacramento Bee on May 7, 2003, that they were, quote, looking at one individual, but they didn't elaborate any further.
I mean, I think we could all take a guess on who that one person could be, right?
Yes, 100%. And the mystery did not last for long. The next week, authorities arrested Glenn for the murder of Jan Scharf on May 16, 2003, a year and 2 days after her initial disappearance. Police served a search warrant the day prior and conducted a 24-hour search of Glenn's home in Jackson while he was out of town on a trip at Yosemite. When Glenn returned home at about 5:30 on the evening of the 16th, he was arrested. Officials wouldn't say at that time if they had seized anything, but I have a feeling that they didn't spend 24 hours there for nothing. Lieutenant Kevin House said, quote, "There were a lot of pieces to this puzzle, but the final straw was the lead detective being able to put all those pieces together and present it to the district attorney, who determined that we had enough of a case to make an arrest."
I mean, obviously the public can only put together the pieces that the police have shared, but if they've built a case, they must have had more information than they were letting on at this point.
Yeah, they definitely were keeping parts of this case under wraps, but that also made me wonder why it was so hard to implicate Glenn in the murder any sooner. I think maybe having a full year pass without any word from Jan and no movement on her bank account or her phone probably solidified things and made it easier to convince the court that there was enough evidence to move forward.
That makes sense. Jan's family wasn't notified in advance that Glenn was going to be arrested. But Jan's daughter Amy wasn't shocked by the arrest, saying, quote, "I always hoped for this to happen, but didn't want to let myself expect that it would."
For clarification, Amy is not also Glenn's daughter?
No, Jan had had her before she met Glenn.
Okay, so this is definitely not like a loyalty sort of thing, trying to stay loyal to your father while protecting your mother.
No, not at all. Once Glenn was in custody, police revealed that when deputies originally canvassed the neighborhood the weekend that Jan's car was found, one of the neighbors claimed that she heard a commotion of some sort on May 14th in the evening. Lieutenant House said, quote, "There was a female screaming in distress, and the next thing the neighbor heard was a vehicle leaving at a high rate of speed. There may have been more than one vehicle." The neighbor then asked her roommate to go outside and try to see if there was anything going on. Her roommate noticed that Glenn's truck, which she had seen in the driveway earlier, was gone. Police also confirmed that the results for Jan's blood test from when she believed she was being poisoned came back positive for digoxin. The arrest got the case moving again, but Jan's family and friends still did not have closure. Her daughter Amy told the Sacramento Bee, quote, "We still need to find her, but this definitely helps."
Glenn entered a plea of not guilty on June 9, 2003. The defense's strategy was to create reasonable doubt with a witness. This particular witness claimed that he was an acquaintance of Jan's and that he had seen her driving in the Sacramento area sometime after she was reported missing. For context, that's super close by, like within half an hour. El Dorado County Sheriff's Department confirmed that they were contacted by this man after Jan's disappearance, but the sighting was never verifiable. The prosecution, on the other hand, had an overwhelming amount of circumstantial evidence that all pointed at Glenn. The prosecution made the case that Glenn's life began to fall apart when he received the divorce papers in May of 2002 and had begun snooping online and found out that Jan had started seeing new people.
It will never make sense to me that you can be so angry that your wife is seeing someone new after initiating a divorce when you're also seeing someone else.
Yeah, and the worst part about that is the fact that Glenn hadn't just started seeing someone either. His former girlfriend Amy testified and said that they had met in 1997, and she was unaware that he was married. In fact, Amy didn't find out that Glenn was married until Jan called her and told her so. When Amy confronted Glenn, he told her that they were separated, which was obviously not true. Amy and Glenn continued their relationship, and by May of 2002, he was spending a significant amount of time at her home in Amador County. Amy said that Glenn spent the night at her house on May 13th, 2002, and said that he would be doing laundry at the marital home on the night of the 14th. She didn't see him again until 11 a.m. on May 16th, when she arrived home and he was burning pine needles in her yard.
Oh, you know, super casual, strange activity to be engaging in randomly on a Wednesday, but, you know, that's fine, I guess.
Super strange from my perspective, too, although she did claim in court that he had done this once before for her. She later found some of his clothing in her dryer, specifically a jumpsuit and underwear. Obviously, he wouldn't need to be doing laundry at her house the day after he had just done laundry at the marital home unless he didn't do laundry at the marital home like he claimed that he was going to. And then she didn't see him for the rest of the weekend and didn't learn about Jan's disappearance until Monday when a friend called her after seeing it on the news. When she confronted Glenn, he said that he didn't know where Jan was and didn't want to worry her. The two broke up later that month, and Amy changed the locks on her home and got an alarm system. When she was asked about her motivations for the upgrade in security, she said it was a combination of events and that she was, quote, afraid with all that was going on.
I mean, yeah, I would also have been super sketched out if my boyfriend didn't even tell me his estranged wife had gone missing. To find out from the news is literally terrifying.
100%. Nothing looks good about that.
The fact that Glenn didn't tell his girlfriend about Jan's disappearance wasn't the only piece of his behavior that authorities felt implicated him in the crime. It wasn't just his girlfriend who he wasn't telling about Jan's disappearance. In fact, Glenn hadn't told anyone that she was missing. Shortly after she disappeared, he changed the locks on the marital home and packed away her clothing. He even changed out her family's photographs around the house and replaced them with his own. Within a few weeks, he had invited two girlfriends to spend the night at the home. District Attorney Trish Kelleher said, quote, he knew she would never be returning to the home. The circumstantial evidence shows that Mr. Sharp had the motive and the opportunity to commit this murder.
Yeah, there's just no way that you're doing all that with the expectation that Jan would one day return home. Even if you're not intimately involved anymore, you don't just get rid of someone's stuff because they went missing.
Definitely. Jan's daughter Amy testified and clarified some of the details on the situation with the missing handgun. Jan had told Amy that she believed Glenn was going through her mail and her email. Jan was so afraid of Glenn that Amy arranged for her fiancé to give Jan a handgun for protection. So it's not even just that a gun went missing from her home, but that it was a secret gun she obtained for the sole purpose of protection against her soon-to-be ex-husband. Amy also testified that when she rushed to the house after finding out that Jan was missing, Glenn told her that Jan, quote, might have gone somewhere, her gym bag is missing.
That's really convenient, seeing as her car was then found at the gym.
Yeah, and that's not the only excuse he made either. The prosecution told the jury that Glenn had multiple responses to others who asked about Jan's disappearance. He had also suggested that she took off with someone online and left to a cold climate because her coats were gone. Again, a real convenient excuse until the prosecution brought out several boxes of items seized from Glenn's storage unit. Included in those boxes were Jan's missing winter coats and her wedding dress.
Clearly, he thought hard enough about how he could lie to make it seem like she left on her own, but he didn't think far enough ahead to not keep the evidence that showed that she clearly didn't. And while Glenn was busy creating multiple scenarios where Jan could have left on her own, he had also told a coworker that, quote, this will be one of those cases where they will never find the body.
Ew.
It also came out that he had previously told a girlfriend that he was never going to allow another woman to do to him what his first wife had done, which was that she had received the house in the divorce.
The only thing that the defense had to hold on to at this point was the hope that the jury would find reasonable doubt because there was no body or crime scene in the case. Even that was a long stretch, though, because the biggest piece of evidence still had not been revealed. Jan's friends and family all knew that she regularly wore a Celtic cross necklace and a ring. After Glenn's arrest, his ex-girlfriend Amy was completing a landscaping project at her home. During the landscaping, a plastic film canister was found in an ivy bush in her front yard. Inside the canister was Jan's necklace and ring.
There's just no plausible explanation that someone could come up with that would place Jan's jewelry in Amy's front yard. There's just no way. How on earth would that happen in a way that doesn't involve Glenn being the one to put it there?
Yeah, and seeing as how Jan and Amy had never met in person, I'd say there's literally no way. That really solidified for the jury that this was no accident and Jan 100% did not just walk away. No one that's walking away from their wonderful life takes off their favorite jewelry and buries it in the bushes of the front yard of the home of your husband's mistress that you've never even been to.
I completely agree. During deliberations, the jury was presented with a lesser charge of second-degree murder to consider. For anyone unfamiliar, in California, there are a few different ways that you can be charged. There's first-degree murder, second-degree, and capital murder. All of these charges require intention to kill and with malice, but the difference between first and second-degree murder is the premeditation of the crime. So second-degree murder ends up carrying a sentence of 15 years to life, where the first-degree murder would be 25 years to life.
I don't see how second-degree murder could possibly fit with this case. Glenn's copious amount of excuses that all seem to self-fulfill, as well as the jewelry discovery and how quickly he started replacing her things, don't say accident to me. He has the weakest alibi on planet Earth. We were in the same house all night and she disappeared. I feel like in order to get dropped to second degree, he would have had to admit to some sort of involvement in order for the jury to think that it wasn't intentional.
I agree, and the jury definitely didn't think that a lesser charge was appropriate. After 2 days of deliberation, they rejected the lesser charge and found Glenn guilty of first-degree murder of Jan Scharf on October 21st, 2004. After finding out everything that her family already knew of Glenn, it makes way more sense to me that they knew that this was a possibility in their future. Jan's sister Becky said, quote, "I'm just incredibly relieved. What remains of our family can start to heal now. This has been holding us hostage." The sentencing hearing would be on November 30th, about a month after the verdict was announced. Just 3 days after his conviction, Glynn attempted suicide. Lieutenant Kevin House said, quote, "He made a comment that there's no future for him, no reason for him to be here." Glynn stated that he would continue to attempt suicide until he was successful.
We've seen quite a few people who maintain their innocence for years and years, filing appeals and trying to convince anyone they can that they aren't guilty of a crime. So for Glynn to jump so quickly to ending his life without even having been sentenced yet, it feels very much like he knows he's guilty, he knows he's been caught, and he's trying to get out.
Yes, definitely. He was upgraded to 24-hour watch, but even that wasn't enough. He attempted suicide again on November 24th, a week before his sentencing hearing. He was still in the county jail system at this point, so they tried to expedite his move to the state jail system, hoping that it would help the situation.
Once reaching the sentencing hearing, Glynn was formally sentenced to 25 years to life in prison. Judge Eddie Keller issued the sentence along with a plea for Jan's family that the location of her body be revealed. He said, quote, "You still have it within your power to give some meaning to your life. I urge you to search your soul and do the right thing and reveal the location of Jan Scharf's body. You may yet have some chance at salvation." Glynn refused to speak at all at the hearing, but his attorney stated that they would be appealing the decision. But Jan's family and friends did not find closure in Glynn's punishment. No punishment by the state would bring back Jan or reveal the location of her body so that they could give her a proper burial and begin to heal. Jan's sister Becky shared some of what the family had experienced since losing her, and it's heartbreaking. Her mother Janice's health had begun to deteriorate quickly, and Becky had to leave her job because of depression and stress. Becky said, quote, "Her daughter Amy will spend every Christmas and every birthday without her mom. He has killed her joy. For me, I will never be able to talk to her, get older with her, share memories together. He took away our pillar. He not only killed Jan, he decimated our family."
Prosecutors read aloud a letter that Jan had written to Glynn before she was murdered. She could no longer tolerate his infidelity and his lies. She wrote, quote, "My only request is that you finally be honest with yourself and with me and decide once and for all what kind of marriage you want. I wish I could know what paths our lives will take from here, but I truly have no idea." Even in the face of divorce, Jan acted with grace and compassion that Glynn clearly took for granted. In May of 2006, Glynn filed for appeal, but it was denied. In January of 2007, they presented a bid to the California Supreme Court to have his case reviewed, and that was also denied. In March of 2007, Glynn made a final suicide attempt and was successful.
Officials searched through Glynn's belongings to try to find clues about the location of Jan's body, but unfortunately, they were unable to find anything. Jan Scharf's body has never been recovered. It's a tragic end to what should have been a divorce. Hopefully, in time, Jan's friends and family can find some form of closure after her loss. For all details and sources regarding this case, you can check the show notes or go to our website, calendarofcrime.com. If you enjoyed this episode, follow us on Instagram and Twitter @calendarofcrime, and we'll be back next week with a brand new case from That Week in History.